Harper. Billy Frost had been fond of the phrase halcyon days, which was how he liked to describe their vineyard summers. "These are the halcyon days," he would say as he steered his Boston whaler out of the harbor. "All hail the halcyon days of summer," he would cry out from the wall in Menemsha, where he and Harper would watch the sun extinguish itself in the ocean as they waited for their fried clams from Larson's fish market to be ready. Billy had used the phrase so often that Harper had finally looked it up. It originated in Greek mythology. Alcyone, the daughter of Aeolus, lost her husband Ceyx in a shipwreck. She drowned herself in the sea, and they were both transformed into halcyon birds, or kingfishers. When Alcyone made a nest on the beach, the waves threatened to sweep it away, so her father, Aeolus, suspended the winds for 7 days, known as the halcyon days, the days when storms do not occur. Days when storms do not occur. Harper enjoys her own string of halcyon days on Nantucket. At first, she doesn't notice anything out of the ordinary, but then it dawns on her. She's happy. Business at the store is booming. Harper, Ainsley, and Kaylee have divided up the schedule so that two of them are always working together at any given time, and they have incorporated the strategies that worked effectively at the party. Fish is stationed outside the store for an hour in the morning and an hour in the afternoon. The rest of the day, he snoozes in the back office or waits for Harper to take him on his walk through town. This daily constitutional always ends at Ramsey's office with a dog treat. Good music plays in the store now at all times, a carefully curated playlist, 90% women, 10% Prince. And every morning, Kaylee posts a photo of herself on social media wearing the outfit of the day, dress, skirt or pants, and top and sandals. It never fails. By day's end, they have sold out of the outfit in all sizes. Megan comes to the store every day with baby David Wayne in his carriage. Harper never holds the baby. She has been afraid of babies since Julian died. But Ainsley and Kaylee dance him around the store while Megan marvels at the previous day's receipts. "I can't believe how well the store is doing," she says. "We are up 500% so far from last summer." Ainsley is happier each day. She hasn't made up with any of her friends, but she seems content spending her free time with Harper and with Kaylee. She asks for their advice about Teddy. After she and Kaylee bumped into him at breakfast, Teddy texted Ainsley saying, "I miss you. Can I call you sometime?" Ainsley hasn't responded to the text, which has led Teddy to send more texts, all of them saying he misses her. "It's like the only way to get him back is to ignore him," Ainsley says. "The conundrum of human relationships," Kaylee says. On days when Harper isn't working, she explores the island. She loads fish into the car and drives up to hike the scenic loop at Squam Swamp. She drives through the moors and swims in the clear green water of Jewel Pond. She packs a picnic and goes to Great Point for the day and climbs to the top of Great Point Light, which even Ainsley and Ramsey, two Nantucket natives, admit they've never done. In the evenings, Harper cooks dinner for Ainsley, and once a week they invite Ramsey over. Harper makes huge composed salads with fresh veggies from Bartlett's farm and grilled shrimp or scallops from 167. She serves the salads with her famous frosted garlic bread, famous to her and Billy anyway. She makes a chilled Thai cucumber coconut soup. She makes peach and blueberry hand pies, which leak fruit and sugar everywhere but are delicious nonetheless. At the end of each day, Harper is more tired than she can remember being in her entire life. She sleeps like a heavy stone resting at the bottom of a pond. Despite her exhaustion and the fact that alcohol turns her stomach now, she lets Ramsey talk her into having an adult evening at the Pearl. She makes it clear to Ainsley, Kaylee, and especially to Ramsey that this is not a date. It's dinner with a friend. "At a very sexy bar," Kaylee says, "be careful. The tuna martini sometimes has strange effects on people." I need help picking out something to wear, Harper says. Why do you care? Ainsley asks. If it's not a date. This is a good question. Harper knows what Ramsay will wear. Khakis, a Vineyard Vines tie, a navy blazer. His hair will be parted to the side and hold comb marks. He will be clean-shaven and will have polished the lenses of his glasses. Harper could get away with a Lily Pulitzer or even with the least suggestive dress ever designed, the Roxy, in petal pink or Barbara Bush blue. But now that she has spent the last few weeks dressing people, she realizes that she has wasted almost 40 years wearing what? Her father's old golf shirts, cut-off shorts, t-shirt dresses from J. Crew, and, to dress up, things off the sale rack at Banana Republic and Ann Taylor Loft. And everything she owns is three sizes too big. It's a revelation to finally own beautiful clothes, feminine clothes, clothes that fit. She wants something fun and distinctive for this dinner. It's her first time going out on Nantucket. She's a different person here. She wants to dress like it. She loves the Parker brand, but she can't pull off sequins or feathers, and their knit dresses are too casual. She tries on dresses by Nanette Lepore and Rebecca Taylor, but the winner, according to both Kaylee and Ainsley, is a white silk Alice and Olivia slip dress with three black lace diamond-shaped inserts running down each side. Because of her dark hair and her summer tan, the black and white combo really pops. Ainsley picks out a black suede choker, and Kaylee selects a pair of black patent leather slides with kitten heels, which is as much heel as Harper can handle. Once dressed, she stands for a moment in front of Tabitha's full-length mirror. She looks good, she thinks, and it has little to do with the dress or the shoes. She is relaxed. She is smiling. The Pearl is a sexy place, swank and stylish. Ramsay has reserved them two corner seats at the White Onyx Bar. The bar is lit from underneath. It emits an otherworldly glow. Two passion fruit martinis, Ramsay says. Harper nearly protests, but a passion fruit martini does sound delicious, and she hopes her stomach issue has finally resolved itself. Harper raises her glass and touches it to Ramsay's. The night is off and running. Ramsay orders for both of them. Duck confit dumplings, the tuna martini with creme fraiche and wasabi tobiko, the 60-second steak topped with a fried quail egg, the stir-fried salt and pepper lobster. And another round of martinis, Ramsay says. The bartender, a pert and pretty blonde with a posh English accent, gives Ramsay and Harper a smile.
I'm glad to see you two back in here, she says. I've missed you.
Oh, Harper says, I'm not. Thank you, Joe, Ramsay says. We've missed you too. With the third martini, and three will be it, Harper decides. Then she'll switch to water. She can finally talk to Ramsay about the things she's afraid to talk to him about during the daylight hours. Do you miss my sister? Harper asks.
I do and I don't, Ramsay says. I'm a fixer by nature. I tried and tried with Tabitha, but I couldn't help her. She wouldn't let me.
Harper nods. She was born 90 seconds before me. She has always been independent and self-sufficient, whereas I always needed help.
So, who is your support? Ramsay asks.
How is Harper to answer that question? In recent years, my love life has been complicated, Harper says, and she shakes her head at the understatement. I had a lover, a married lover.
Ah, Ramsay says.
His name is Reed Zimmer, Harper says. It feels so wonderful to say his name out loud that tears stand in her eyes. He's a fixer, too. A doctor. He was my father's doctor, so he took care of my father, and by association, he took care of me. He has a quiet authority that made me feel safe when I was with him, which of course was foolish because I was the opposite of safe. He belonged to someone else, his wife, Sadie. And I fell into the trap that all mistresses fall into. I believed Sadie didn't matter.
I believed he would leave her for me eventually.
But he didn't, Ramsey says.
Sadie found out about us, Harper says. She caught us together on the night my father died, and then a few days later she made a scene at Billy's funeral. Reed sent me a text message asking me not to contact him for a while.
Harper stares into the bottom of her martini glass. Truth serum. She never talks this much.
But then again, whom does she have to confide in? Only Ramsey, here and now.
I heard from other sources that he moved out. I heard he took a leave of absence from the hospital. I don't know where he is or what he's doing. I don't know if he's still on the vineyard or if he's walking around out in the real world. I don't know if he's looking for me or looking for himself. I feel guilty about what I did to Sadie, but I feel more guilty about what I did to Reed. Because I believe he's a good, true person, and yet somehow I led him astray. I stained his character, shredded his integrity. The night Sadie caught us, I asked him to meet me. He didn't want to, but I begged him.
Well, your father had just died, Ramsey says. Right?
Harper spins her martini glass. I mess up whatever I do, she says. It's like a curse. When our parents divorced and I got to go with Billy, I thought I'd won some kind of contest. But it turns out I'm a loser through and through.
You don't believe that, Ramsey says.
I do. Tabitha does, and I think even my mother does. And my father, right before he died, turned to me and said, I'm sorry, kiddo. At first I wasn't sure what he meant, but I figured it out. He was sorry I was the way I was. He was sorry he couldn't help me.
Harper, come on, Ramsey says. You are a beautiful, intelligent woman. Every bit as intriguing as your sister, but, if I may say so, way more fun.
So much fun that I barely graduated from Tulane, Harper says. So much fun that while I was cocktail waitressing at this place in Edgartown called Dahlia's, I agreed to deliver a package for a guy everyone knew was a drug dealer. I got arrested, ratted him out, brought down the whole operation.
Ramsey's eyes grew wide behind his glasses. You're kidding.
But that's not the worst thing I've ever done, Harper says. And sleeping with Dr. Zimmer isn't the worst thing either.
Do I dare ask? Ramsey says.
Harper studied him. Tabitha never told you why we don't speak? She never hinted?
Never,
Ramsey says. His face is earnest, but Harper can't believe that Tabitha lived with someone for so long and didn't tell him about the night Julian died.
Well, Harper says, she's not sure what to say. She almost wishes Tabitha had given her version of the story so that Harper could confirm or deny. She drains the last sip of her martini. What she really wants is a shot of Jaeger. Tabitha blames me for Julian's death. Ramsey shakes his head like he's trying to clear water from his ears.
What? He says. Why? Why would she do that?
But this is beyond Harper's ability to answer. She slides off her bar stool and stares at him, willing him to understand that she did not smother Julian with a blanket or drown him in the bathtub or shake him because he wouldn't stop crying. Harper should explain the events of that day, that night, but even now, 14 years later, it's too painful to revisit.
Thank you for dinner, she says, and she leaves the restaurant. She turns back once to look at Ramsey. He is sitting, stunned, and makes no move to follow her. She walks all the way home in her bare feet, kitten heels be damned, and thinks to herself, the halcyon days, days when no storms occur, are over. She can't last a second longer. She pulls out her phone and stares at the screen. It shows a long-ago photo of her and Billy on the boat, with Billy holding up a striped bass, willing herself to let reason rule here. But no, sorry. She calls Reed and is shuttled to his voicemail. She has something to tell him. It's only a hunch,
but she can't leave it in a message. She hangs up. But then, almost immediately, Harper's phone rings. Reed? Or is it Ramsey, just now recovering from his shock? Harper waits for the ringing to stop and the chime to sound indicating a voicemail, then she checks her display. It's an unfamiliar Vineyard number, exchange 693. She stops in her tracks on the side of Cliff Road. Maybe it's Reed, calling from a landline. It's a moment or two before Harper can bring herself to listen to the message. Harper, hello. This is Edie Donegal, Brendan's mother. I understand you might still be away, but I felt the need to call you. Brendan isn't doing well. I know you care about him, and as much as I don't want to impose, I can't help but ask if you might be able to visit him sometime soon. It's the only thing I can think of that might help. Thank you, Harper. Good night. Harper's head suddenly feels too heavy to hold up. Brendan. Poor Brendan. And yet in her current state of mind, Harper doesn't believe she can help Brendan. She will only make things worse. She deletes the message. She can't take another step. Her stomach roils and green waves of nausea wash over her. She vomits into the grass on the side of the road. More than a hunch, she thinks. She knows. She's pregnant. Nantucket. A stretch of days arrives when the weather is so brutal that it's the only thing people want to talk about. It's 87 degrees at noon, unheard of since the heat wave of 1936. The brick sidewalks of town bake in the sun. The beaches are unbearable. There is no breeze, no clouds, not a second's respite from the punishing heat. It's too hot to gossip. Nobody can sit still long enough to listen. But the insurance offices of Stryker and McLean are mightily air-conditioned, so much so that every client who walks in sighs with the deliciousness of it. Purcell Ott sinks into the armchair next to the desk of the receptionist, Bonnie Atkinson. Purcell tells Bonnie he needs to see Ramsey Stryker about a windshield replacement. "But no hurry," Purcell says to Bonnie. "I could sit here all day." Bonnie rolls her eyes. Purcell is a retiree who likes the sound of his own voice. She isn't about to get sucked into his vortex. "I'll let Ramsey know you're here," Bonnie says. Ramsey works back in the corner of the office, and Bonnie notices his privacy walls are up, which is unusual. Bonnie has worked at Stryker and McLean for 21 years, and she can't remember this ever happening before. Intellectually, she realizes that privacy panels mean that Ramsey would like privacy, but Bonnie suffers from an acute case of natural curiosity. She peeks through the crack and sees Ramsey intently studying his computer screen. Bonnie's hand flies to her chest. Pornography? She never pegged Ramsey for the pornography type. He's handsome enough to have any woman he wants. Look at the 22-year-old bartender he dated for nearly 3 months. But then Bonnie squares her expectations with reality. Everyone watches porn. Everyone except Bonnie and her husband, Norm Atkinson. Norm watches reruns of The Andy Griffith Show. "Excuse me, Ramsey," Bonnie says. "Purcell Ott is here to see you." Ramsey startles as if he has indeed been caught at some illicit activity. Over his shoulder, however, Bonnie catches a glimpse of the screen. It's an old article from the Inquirer and Mirror. Ramsey stands and moves aside one of the privacy panels. "Thanks, Bonnie," Ramsey says. "I know Mr. Ott isn't your favorite. I'll handle him." He strides down the hall, leaving Bonnie to stand at the opening of his office. Most of us may claim that we would never do what Bonnie Atkinson then did, but most of us would be lying. Bonnie steps quickly over to Ramsey's computer and scans the contents of the screen. It's an obituary, she realizes. An obituary for an infant boy, Julian Wyatt Cruz, born May 28, 2003, died August 15, 2003. Bonnie inhales sharply. Not even 3 months old. The cause of death is stated as respiratory failure.
Why would Ramsay be interested in this? Bonnie wonders.
Then she sees the names of the surviving family. Father, Wyatt Cruz. Mother, Tabitha Frost.
The other place that is lavishly air-conditioned during the hideous heat wave is the ERF boutique. We understand the rationale. Nobody wants to try on clothes when she's sweating, and in weather such as this, all air-conditioned venues are seeing an increase in foot traffic. At 11 o'clock on the fifth day of unbearable hellfire heat, Kaylee Keohane is experiencing a lull in her workday. The store has been empty just long enough for her to wonder, is this heat wave a result of global warming? And is the new president planning on doing anything about it?
Kaylee is bored.
It's Ainsley's day off. She said she was going to stay home, eat ice chips, and binge on girls. And Harper arrived at work in such a foul mood that Kaylee suggested she take a long lunch, maybe drive her Bronco out to 40th Pole and go for a swim. Initially, Kaylee had thought Harper's mood was attributable to the heat, but when she thinks back, she realizes that Harper has been irritable since her non-date date with Ramsay. Did something happen? Did Ramsay make moves on Harper against her wishes, or did he not make moves when she wanted him to? Kaylee can't ask Harper these questions because she and Harper haven't developed the closeness that Kaylee and Ainsley have. Harper is always friendly, always congenial, but she holds personal information in reserve. As Kaylee is cogitating on what might be up with Harper, the door opens, and a dark-haired girl wanders in, holding an iced coffee. The girl looks familiar, but before Kaylee can suss out who she is, she has to deal with business.
I'm sorry, Kaylee says, trying to sound genuinely sorry and not merely annoyed, although really, there is a sign on the door that says, no food, no drink, no exceptions. You'll have to leave your coffee outside.
The girl tilts her head and hitches up the strap of what Kaylee thinks is a Chloe hobo bag in saddle-tone leather.
When I was here before, there was food and drink. What's up with that?
Then Kaylee realizes this girl with the $2,500 bag is Ainsley's friend, or former friend, Emma. Unlike Harper, Ainsley has confided everything about her personal life to Kaylee. She told Kaylee that she stole gin from her grandmother's house and that Emma planted it in Candace's locker. But then somehow the situation flipped on its head and Emma and Candace ganged up on Ainsley and Ainsley ended up serving a 3-day in-school suspension. Then the girls egged her house. It's enough to take Kaylee back to the heartache of her own high school days. Kids are cruel because they are jealous or confused or simply badly parented. Ainsley has told Kaylee that Emma lives with her father, Dutch, who owns the restaurant at the Nantucket Airport. The mother lives somewhere in Florida. Apparently, Emma never sees her. Kaylee feels for any child who has lost a parent to either death or desertion. Kaylee's own mother died of breast cancer 3 years ago, and Kaylee misses her every second of every day. But she also suspects that in Emma's case, a lack of a mother has curdled her soul until it's as sour as a glass of expired milk.
That was a special occasion, Kaylee says. We don't allow food or drink during regular business hours. I'm sorry. You're welcome to finish your coffee outside.
Emma places the cup on the front step. Kaylee will bet $50 that she forgets all about it and leaves it for Kaylee to throw away.
Thanks, Kaylee says. Now, can I help you find something?
Actually, Emma says, I'm looking for Ainsley. Is she here?
She's not, Kaylee says, though certainly that's apparent. The store is deserted. It's her day off.
Oh, Emma says, lucky her.
She takes an ERF dress off the rack, long-sleeved with a floppy bow at the neck, reminiscent of what Dustin Hoffman wore in Tootsie, and holds it up against her body.
This is hideous.
Kaylee happens to agree, but she isn't about to bond with Emma over taste, nor is she going to let Emma insult the signature brand.
I'll tell Ainsley you stopped in, she says.
Emma sniffs and heads to the part of the boutique that features the other, younger lines. She fingers a black beaded parka top.
I have this in white, Emma says.
Kaylee smiles blandly. Emma moves to the table where the littles are kept. Rope belts, scarves, sunglasses, and the jar of lacy thongs. She fingers the scarves, inspects the belts, tries on the sunglasses. Kaylee stifles a yawn. Nora Jones sings Come Away With Me. Then suddenly, Kaylee gets an idea.
I have to use the ladies' room, she says. I'll be back in a minute.
Whatevs, Emma says.
Kaylee steps into the back office and closes the door firmly with a click. She brings up the store surveillance camera on her phone as she strides with heavy wedge-heeled footsteps down the hallway. Sure enough, Emma Marlowe's head is on a swivel, checking the store for cameras, but the camera Eleanor had installed is designed to look like a sprinkler head. Emma reaches into the glass jar and grabs two lace thongs. She drops the $36 worth of merchandise into her $2,500 bag. If it were anyone else, Kaylee would have handled the shoplifting herself. But for Emma, Kaylee calls the police.
Gotcha, she thinks.
Nobody is surprised to hear that Emma Marlowe has gotten caught stealing. Even the officer who responds, Sergeant Royal DeLeo, is unsurprised. He has busted up every teenage beer party this summer, and Emma, with her snarky, entitled attitude, has been present at them all. People are surprised to hear that Dutch Marlowe actually leaves the airport restaurant in order to come to the store and lobby on his daughter's behalf. Little does he know that this unprecedented bit of parental support will backfire. For the second he walks into the ERF boutique and sees that it's Kaylee Keohane who has caught his daughter, he is sorry indeed. Kaylee's eyes shoot streams of green fire at Dutch.
What are you doing here? She asks.
That's my dad, Emma says.
You're,
Kaylee says.
Dutch runs a hand over his shaved head and silently begs the young woman not to disclose how she knows him. It was Dutch Marlowe who grabbed Kaylee's perfect peach of an ass, causing her to unload a Jack and Coke in his lap. She had then been fired by Shorty, the manager at the Straight Wharf. Shorty hadn't wanted to fire Kaylee. She was a tireless worker with a great personality, a winning combination in the service industry, where so often you get either one or the other. And he was 100% sure that Dutch had grabbed Kaylee's ass. But unfortunately, Shorty had no choice. He was a regular at the Wednesday night poker game at Dutch's house, and he was in to Dutch for $4,500. Dutch, as we all know, is a person with absolutely no conscience. But he had felt guilty about getting Kaylee fired. He hadn't meant to pinch her ass, meaning it hadn't been premeditated, but she had been out from behind the bar a lot that night, waving her tush around in those white jeans like a matador waving a red flag in front of a bull. What could Dutch say? He was a man, horny all the time, and lonely besides. But still, he doesn't love the idea of Emma hearing that her father is a lecherous jerk. Kaylee snarls.
Your dad? She says.
She takes a deep breath and prepares to tell Emma the truth about her father, but in the end she just shakes her head.
Why am I not surprised?
Martha's Vineyard. The island is so crowded in July that we fear it might tip over. Down Island will nosedive, upending Chilmark and Aquinnah. The population hits 90,000, then 91,000. The steamship sits so low in the water, weighted down with Jeeps, Land Rovers, Hummers, that it reminds us of a pregnant woman after the baby drops. State Beach is parked out by 9 in the morning. The Port Hunter has a 2-hour wait for a table. The line at the Bight has 111 people in it at 5:30, which increases to 147 people at 6:30. There is an average of 15 car accidents a day. 6 of these involve taxis. And yet, who among us hasn't longed for these summer days? Indians and IODs tack and jibe in Edgartown Harbor. Tennis balls hit the foul line at the field club,
eliciting our best John McEnroe imitations. That ball was in. Chalk flew up all over the place.
Daughters of the Scions of Industry tan their breasts on the shores of Lucy Vincent. Authors come nightly to read at Bunch of Grapes. Charles Bach, Jane Green, Richard Russo. Skip Gates rides his tricycle out to Katama. Keith Richards takes his grandchildren to pick blueberries at the patch off of Middle Road. Noah Mayhew, the reservationist at the Covington, becomes so overwhelmed by calls from demanding and entitled people that he quits and moves to an ashram in Oregon. Upon hearing this news about her great-nephew, Noah, Indira Mayhew, who has worked as the Chappie ferrymaster for nearly 40 years aboard the On Time 2, thinks seriously about following suit, although she has never practiced yoga. With all this happening, how does anyone have time to figure out what's going on at Billy Frost's house? Daggett Avenue is an average year-round part of Tisbury that falls beneath most people's notice. And from the curb, the house looks the same. If someone had been staking out the street, selling lemonade on the corner or casing the neighborhood with criminal intent, he might have noticed Franklin Phelps's truck driving around the neighborhood, and further snooping would have revealed Franklin's truck parked in Billy's backyard. But no one is staking out the street. Franklin has been careful to hire subcontractors from off-island. The electrician hails from Falmouth, the plumber from Mashpee. These guys don't know who from what as far as vineyard gossip is concerned. They just come in and do the work. The only person Franklin trusts, and for this project, needs, is Tad Morrissey. Tad is Franklin's right-hand man. He can do anything. Tile, plaster, cabinetry, and he does so without complaining. Also, despite being Irish, he's a man of few words. A human vault. Franklin doesn't have to explain the fine print to Tad, but he does it anyway. My sister cannot find out that we are renovating Billy Frost's house. Do you understand? Tad nods with his mouth full of nails. Franklin worries that someone saw him with Tabitha that first night at the Ritz and reported back to Sadie, thinking Tabitha was Harper, but by the following day, when he hadn't heard about it, he figured he was safe. He had been clear with Annalisa at the Outermost Inn. I'm bringing in Tabitha Frost, Harper's twin sister, and nobody can know. Franklin has known Annalisa since elementary school. He told her he trusted her with his life, hoping that would be enough to ensure her silence. A few days after Franklin starts seeing Tabitha and working full-time on her house, he is summoned to his parents' home in Katama for dinner. His mother doesn't use a cell phone or a computer, so she tapes an index card to the front door of his cottage on Grovedale Road in Oak Bluffs that says, Dinner Monday, 6 p.m. Franklin is lucky he even sees this minimalist invitation. He has spent every night with Tabitha at Billy's house. He stops at home only to get clothes and, finally, to grab his electric razor. He sighs. He can't, obviously, take Tabitha to his parents' house for dinner. All hell will break loose. All hell is going to break loose anyway, he realizes, but he can stave it off a little while longer. And in fact, things at the Phelps's that evening start out fine. Tabitha accepts the news that Franklin is eating with his parents with equanimity. She says she's going to stay home and paint the powder room a shade of silvery gray called Paul Revere's Ride. Franklin approves. Tabitha's taste is impeccable, which is to say, it matches his own. The elder Phelpses are in good spirits, as ever. Al Phelps is a favorite with nearly all of us because he was such a dedicated and benevolent principal during his tenure at the high school, and now, in retirement, he runs errands to Shirley's and Mocha Mott's, seemingly just so he can spread goodwill. He is famous for buying his former students a cup of coffee. Meanwhile, Lydia is an active member of the Excellent Point book group, and she volunteers each week at the Island Food Pantry. Both the elder Phelpses embrace their son. Lydia runs a hand over Franklin's now smooth face. I'm glad you shaved, she says. Christine Vellman told me she saw you stopped at the Barnes Road intersection and that you were growing a beard. No,
Franklin says. He shakes his head. If Christine Vellman reported back to his mother about the state of his facial hair, how long will it be before someone tells Lydia that Franklin is dating the twin sister of the woman who betrayed Sadie, and worse, is working on their father's house? Al Phelps claps his son on the back. Can I buy you a beer? Please, Franklin says. Sadie arrives in short order, which is good, Franklin thinks, because it doesn't leave Lydia any time to talk about her. One look at his sister, however, tells Franklin what his mother would have said if she'd had the chance. Sadie has lost at least 10 pounds, and she wasn't a very big person to begin with. Her cheeks are sunken. Her face, for lack of a better word, looks cadaverous. She keeps her hair very short, but now it looks as if she's taken kitchen shears to it in a fit of grief. There are purplish red circles under her eyes, and she is shaking. Franklin's heart sinks. He knows that Sadie has closed the pie shop until further notice, but he had hoped she would have taken the hiatus to rest and recoup. He had hoped she would rise above her circumstances and maybe even revel in her newfound independence. Reed betrayed her. Yes, he did. He cheated on her with the daughter of one of his patients, a woman whose morals were already held in question by most of the island because of her involvement with Joey Bowen. Franklin has refrained from sharing his opinion with his sister, which is that he doesn't think Harper is a bad person. He has always liked her. She has been a fan of his music. She came to see him every time he played and was the first person to buy his ill-fated CD of original songs. Harper has never been anything but sweet and lovely to him, and he had witnessed firsthand the crap she had to put up with as a cocktail waitress at Dahlia's. Those girls were teased and manhandled and harassed. A chance to quit slinging drinks and do something far easier, if illegal and dangerous, for Joey Bowen must have seemed like an answer of sorts. Franklin also believes that no affair is ever one partner's fault. It signifies the collapse of the union. This past winter, Franklin stopped by Reed and Sadie's house to get a prescription for a Z-Pak. Franklin had a nasty case of bronchitis that was wreaking havoc with his carpentry and singing. It was a Sunday afternoon. Sadie was at the pie shop, and Reed was home alone, drinking an 18-year-old Aberlour, watching the Patriots in the playoffs. He invited Franklin to stay. He held up his glass. Aberlour has its own medicinal properties, you know. After they had each had two glasses, Franklin's with water, Reed's straight. Reed muted the television. The Pats were winning in a blowout. Reed said, "Does your sister ever say if she's happy being married to me?" The question was as welcome as a bowling ball to the groin. Franklin sucked in a breath and opened his mouth to reassure his brother that yes, his sister was happy. Of course she was happy. Why wouldn't she be happy? It was island-wide opinion that Dr. Reed Zimmer was a great guy. Reliable, trustworthy, dedicated. A Martha's Vineyard treasure, a hero even. But Franklin had, in fact, accidentally overheard Sadie talking to their mother, Lydia, during one of the family dinners Reed hadn't been able to attend because he'd been called into the hospital. Sadie had been venting to Lydia because Reed had suddenly decided he wanted children. "But I won't do it," Sadie had said, "and I will punish him until he takes the words back." Franklin had stopped listening at that point. He had sought refuge with his father, who was loath to talk about anything more controversial than local politics. "I don't know," Franklin said to his brother-in-law. He and Reed had never had a heart-to-heart chat before. He didn't know Reed was capable of it. But of course Reed needed a confidant. Everyone did. "We haven't slept together in over a year," Reed said. He had slugged back his scotch and poured another two fingers. "And I'm talking sex, but I'm also telling you we now keep different bedrooms. She won't touch me at all, Franklin." Franklin had been muted by discomfort. The next to last thing he wanted to hear about was his sister's sex life. The last thing he wanted to hear about was his parents' sex life. But he put two and two together and deduced that cutting Reed off was Sadie's way of exacting her punishment.
Now, Franklin is not saying Reed was justified in having an affair, but he isn't sure how Sadie saw that strategy working out to her advantage, other than that it would ensure she wouldn't have a child. At this point, neither does she have a husband. They sit down to dinner promptly at 6. Franklin's mother doesn't believe in a cocktail hour. She claims hors d'oeuvres ruin the appetite. She also has no use for seasonality. It's mid-July, and she has made a pot roast with potatoes and carrots and onions, snowflake rolls from scratch, and an iceberg salad with bottled blue cheese dressing. Franklin has warned his mother that one day the Martha's Vineyard Farmers Market police are going to arrest her simply for serving iceberg lettuce. But Lydia feels no shame. Franklin sweats his way through the meal in more ways than one. All he can do is hope that his mother made pie for dessert, peach or triple berry. He pictures Tabitha rolling Paul Revere's ride onto the powder room walls, a few specks of paint dotting her nose. She had told him right before he left that Wyatt, her children's father, was a professional house painter and had long ago taught her how to tape off a room. The thunderbolt of jealousy Franklin experienced nearly caused him to pass out. It was only on the way to his parents' house that he thought, children? He has only heard about the daughter, Ainsley. So, Sadie says, contributing to conversation for the first time, where are you working these days, Frankie? The childhood nickname is a playful touch. Maybe she's not as damaged as she looks. But even so, Franklin can't own up to the truth. He harbors the naive belief that if he just lets some more time pass, Sadie's mindset will improve, and she won't care when he tells her he's seeing Tabitha Frost. And the word seeing doesn't begin to convey how he feels. He's gobsmacked. He's neck deep in emotion for the woman. Cutty hunk, he says nonchalantly. Really, she says. Her tone is indecipherable. Is she calling his bluff or merely impressed? Really, he says. So you're using the boat then? She asks. You should take me over there sometime. We can all go, Lydia says. Now, now, honey, Al says. Franklin is working. I am working, Franklin says. Believe me, there's nothing I'd rather do than have the three of you join me for a leisurely day on Cuttyhunk, but it isn't really feasible with a project I'm involved in. Of course not, Al says. Sadie stares at him. Franklin leaves his parents' house that evening with his secret intact, but how much longer can he hope to keep it that way? Not much longer, we all suspect. Because who has ever successfully kept a secret on this island? It's 3 days later when Tad Morrissey is backing up in the parking lot of Cottle's Lumberyard in Edgartown and gets T-boned from the right by Roger Dorr, who had parked in the Cottle's lot but spent nearly an hour over at Coop's Bait and Tackle talking about where the stripers are running and, apparently, nipping from the flask of Bushmills he takes with him everywhere. Tad recognizes Roger Dorr but doesn't properly know him, and the accident has brought out Tad's infrequently seen Irish temper. What the hell? He shouts. You just rammed right into me! Roger Dorr tucks the flask under the passenger seat and climbs out of his truck to inspect the damage he did to the vehicle of the angry young man. His wife, Cecily, is going to clobber him. Roger has retired as a general contractor and now works solely as an odd jobs man. But he is selective with his clients and therefore spends most of his time either fishing in his 13-foot whaler or golfing with Smitty at Farm Neck. And drinking, of course, but only during the day. Roger Dorr is routinely in bed by 8:30. Tad also gets out to inspect the damage and finds a dent the size of Quits a Pond in the side panel of his F-250. He feels heat rising from the soles of his feet, and his hands start to itch. He wants to punch the old man right in the face, break his nose, bust open his lip. Tad feels about his truck the way most people feel about their children. Sorry about that, Roger says. He steps closer to Tad and lowers his voice. Think we can work something out without getting insurance involved? Like hell, Tad says. He has lived on the island for 7 years and has seen the likes of Roger Dor way too often. Old salts who think they can say anything and do anything because one of their ancestors was banging the original Martha who owned the vineyard.
I'm calling the police.
Roger Dor's shoulders slump. Cecily will have his head on a platter. A little while later, Sergeant Drew Truman is on the scene, filing an accident report. He knows Roger Dor from the Rotary Club, which is a point in Roger's favor, although it seems like Roger might be at fault.
Give him a breathalyzer, Tad says. He's been drinking.
I beg your pardon, young man, Roger says.
I have to get back to work,
Tad says, pointing to the back of his pickup, which is filled with 2x4s and sheets of plywood.
I'm on a deadline.
Is it possible that Roger Dor has been drinking? Drew wonders. It's only 11 o'clock in the morning. The younger gentleman is calling for a breathalyzer, but it comes across as though he's telling Drew how to do his job, at which Drew takes umbrage. He decides just to give Roger Dor a moving violation and puts him at fault for the accident. Their insurance companies can battle it out. In an attempt to make nice with the hot-headed Irish guy, Drew realizes he's met him once before, at the bar at Sharky's, where he was watching soccer and screaming at the TV. He says,
Where are you working?
Daggett Avenue, Tad says.
He pulls his phone out of his back pocket and checks the time.
This bleeder cost me 45 minutes I don't have, and now I'm looking at trying to get back to Tisbury in lunchtime traffic.
Drew nods sympathetically. Traffic is every vineyarder's favorite thing to complain about, followed closely by mopeds and taxi drivers, which are really just subcategories of traffic.
Daggett Avenue?
Roger Dor says. Despite enjoying half a flask, at least, of Bushmills, he experiences a moment of lucidity.
Are you the one working on Billy Frost's house?
Tad stares at the old man.
Billy Frost's house?
Just hearing the name Frost causes Sergeant Drew Truman to suffer chest pain. He had fallen for Harper Frost, but what a fool he had been. Just last week, Drew had pulled over a Rooster Express truck for making an illegal U-turn on Meeting House Road. Drew had entertained the faintest hope that he would find Harper driving, but it had been Rooster himself. He told Drew that he had fired Harper and that she had left Island. Drew studies Tad.
Are you working on Billy Frost's house?
Tad shrugs.
Does it matter? Or can I go?
Just answer the question, please, sir,
Drew says, though he knows the question is out of bounds.
Are you working on Billy Frost's house?
Tad has promised Franklin that he will keep his mouth shut about the job, but he isn't about to lie to an officer of the law. And this guy, he knows, is a hometown hero and a member of one of the most prominent families in Oak Bluffs. He probably has the power to make Tad's life miserable in ways Tad can't even imagine. Besides, he needs to get out of there. His poor truck.
Yeah, Tad says.
And who is it you work for?
Drew asks, though suddenly he knows the answer because they talked about it at the bar at Sharky's.
He works for...
Tad knows this is it. The end of Franklin's fantasy that he could work on Billy Frost's house and have a wild-ass love affair with Harper Frost's twin sister, Tabitha, without anyone finding out about it.
Oh, well, Tad thinks.
Franklin Phelps, Tad says. Since Drew broke up with Harper, he has only one confidant, Chief Oberg. The chief has been very patient and nurturing with his sergeant because Drew Truman is a straight arrow with unimpeachable character and integrity. And with the current troubling atmosphere surrounding law enforcement, Chief Oberg has devoted himself to focusing on the cops he considers his shining stars. When Drew gets back to the station, he finds Chief Oberg in the break room eating kale salad out of a Tupperware container. He tells the chief about the accident. Then he reveals that Franklin Phelps is working on Billy Frost's house.
That's weird, right? Because Harper was having an affair with Dr. Zimmer, and Dr. Zimmer is married to Sadie, who is Franklin Phelps' sister. That's a conflict of interest, right?
Chief Oberg stabs a piece of kale. His wife, Joanne, is on a diet. And when Joanne is on a diet, the whole house is on a diet. After his shift, he's going to stop at Shiretown Meats for an Italian sub with extra hot peppers.
It's the vineyard, Drew, the chief says. Everything here is a conflict of interest.
He says this to placate his young colleague, and Drew thanks him dutifully and wanders away. But the person who does agree with Drew that it's a conflict of interest is Shirley Sparks, Chief Oberg's administrative assistant, whose desk is right outside the break room. Shirley is in the Excellent Point book group with Franklin's and Sadie's mother, Lydia Phelps, and she finds it interesting, indeed startling, that Franklin is working on the house of the father of the woman who betrayed his sister. She wonders if Lydia knows about this. If she does know about it, she must need someone to talk to. And if she doesn't know about it, she should. Shirley calls Lydia. Ainsley. What started out as the worst summer of her life has gotten better. First, Ainsley succeeded in recapturing Teddy's interest. Since bumping into him at 21 Broad, he has texted her every day, asking when he can see her, when they can hang out. Both Kaylee and Harper counsel Ainsley to be slow and measured in her responses. Ainsley does love Teddy, but he hurt her, emotionally for certain, but also physically that afternoon in the cubby. And Ainsley isn't sure that getting back together with Teddy is what she wants. It's nice to have him in pursuit, however. A lot nicer than pining away for him. Kaylee catches Emma shoplifting two pairs of hanky-panky low-rise thongs from the store, and she calls the police. Dutch shows up to get Emma off the hook, but his appearance only makes things worse because it turns out that Dutch Marlowe was the one who got Kaylee fired from the Straight Wharf. Ainsley's head spins at this news. On the one hand, she thinks, of course it was dirty, disgusting Dutch Marlowe who grabbed Kaylee's ass. And then somehow Dutch managed to turn the tables so that Kaylee was the one who got fired. On the other hand, Ainsley is grateful to Dutch because if Kaylee hadn't gotten fired, she wouldn't be working at the ERF boutique and they wouldn't now be friends. Kaylee has taught Ainsley so much about grace and kindness and the power of pure intentions. She leads by example. After breaking up with Ramsey, she has chosen not to date anyone else for a while. She wants to spend time with herself, she says. Ainsley loves this idea. She decides that she may get back together with Teddy down the road, but for the rest of the summer and the beginning of her junior year, she is going to spend time with herself. She has gone beyond her summer reading assignments and is devouring all of Edith Wharton, book by book. She has started getting up earlier so she can jog down the Cliff Road bike path, to the water tower and back, 2 miles round trip, before work. She has signed up for a class at the corner table called Cooking Basics because one of the things she loves about Aunt Harper is her home-cooked meals. Ainsley imagines her mother returning to find her daughter well-read, in shape, and accomplished in the kitchen. A text arrives from Teddy a few days after Ainsley told him about the shoplifting that says, "Did you hear the latest about Emma?" Ainsley's insides turn cold. Has Emma been hurt? Has Emma been in an accident? Has Emma died? The thought is, frankly, horrifying, which also shows how much Ainsley has evolved. A few weeks earlier, Emma's untimely demise seemed like the only answer to ending Ainsley's agony. "What?" she texts back. "Dutch is sending her to boarding school," Teddy says, "in Pennsylvania, the George School." Ainsley shrieks. Emma is going to boarding school in Pennsylvania. Ainsley can't believe how ecstatic this news makes her. The prospect of finishing high school without having to deal with either Emma the enemy or even Emma the friend is like a golden sunrise. Ainsley can start fresh. She can reinvent herself. She can be good. "I wish her well," she texts. It's a Tuesday. And Ainsley is working with Kaylee when Candace Beasley walks into the boutique. Ainsley gasps. Candace has cut off her hair. Her long, shiny strawberry blonde locks have been hacked into a blunt bob that barely clears the back of her neck. She still wears the grosgrain headband, however. Today's is black with tiny white polka dots, and it matches her simple outfit of white current Elliot boyfriend shorts and a scoop-neck black t-shirt. Once Ainsley recovers from the surprise of Candace's haircut, she grows wary about why Candace is here. Maybe she has come to finish what Emma started. Maybe there's a snub-nosed revolver in Candace's straw clutch. Kaylee reaches out to touch Ainsley's shoulder. She must recognize Candace.
"Can I help you?"
Kaylee says.
"Oh," Candace says, "I came to talk to Ainsley."
There are three other women browsing. One is a woman named Lisa Hawkwarder, who has spent more than $5,000 in the boutique so far this summer. She religiously follows Kaylee's Facebook posts and nearly always comes in to try on and then buy the outfit of the day. She also bought a vintage men's watch because she loves the way Harper wears Billy's watch. Ainsley, Kaylee, and Harper all fawn over Lisa, not just because she's their best customer, but also because she's irreverent and funny. She's a reading specialist in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, and she has a Rottweiler black lab mix named Potter, who has become best friends with Fish. Ainsley says,
"You can help Lisa. I'm okay."
"You sure?" Kaylee says. Ainsley steps out from behind the register to help Candace.
"Your hair."
"My mother forced me to donate 14 inches to Locks of Love," Candace says.
"Forced you?"
Ainsley says.
"I had to make amends," Candace says.
"I've gone way off the rails this summer, according to my parents." Ainsley shrugs.
"You hang out with Emma.
Emma invented off the rails.
Did you hear she's going to boarding school?"
"I did," Ainsley says. "Teddy told me." She says this is a jab, but Candace remains unfazed.
"Teddy and I broke up," Candace says. "It was never that serious."
"Well," Ainsley says,
"it seriously hurt my feelings."
"I know," Candace says. She wanders over to a rack holding several Roxy dresses in a rainbow of colors and fingers the obi of the one in peach.
"I came in to apologize to you. I should never have gotten mixed up with Teddy or with Emma. I guess..."
Her voice trails off, and Ainsley sees her eyes shining with tears.
"I was hurt back when you... when we stopped being friends. I didn't understand it. You dropped me because I wasn't cool enough. And now I understand that I wasn't cool enough. I matured more slowly than you did. I couldn't have kept up with you and Emma."
Ainsley blinks.
"I was cruel to you. I'm the one who should be apologizing."
"No," Candace says. She shakes her head and her short hair shimmies.
"Let me finish. I wanted to be friends with Emma, and I wanted to date Teddy. Not because they were suited for me, but because you had them. It's okay, Candace. I egged your house with Emma."
"I know.
I get sick when I think about it," Candace says.
Ainsley gives her a sad smile.
"Me too. Part of me believes that with Emma leaving, you and I can be friends again."
Ainsley thinks about this.
"Maybe we can," she says. "But I'm holding off on having a boyfriend for a while, and I'm also holding off on having a best friend."
"Fair enough," Candace says. She stuffs her hands into the front pockets of her shorts and tilts her head.
"Is it true that your mother left for a while and her twin sister came to take her place?"
"Yeah," Ainsley says, "but that's not as crazy as it sounds." Or maybe it is as crazy as it sounds, Ainsley thinks later. When she's finished at work, she checks her phone. She has been so absorbed in her own drama that she's lost track of her mother. The last time Tabitha called was 5 days earlier. Is that possible? Ainsley sits on a bench on Main Street near the place where she has chained her bike and does the unthinkable. She voluntarily calls her mother.
"Darling," Tabitha says.
She sounds happy, giddy even, and Ainsley reels for a second. Xanax, maybe?
"Hi, Mama," she says, I was just thinking about you, Tabitha says. You should see what we're doing to Gramps' house. It was a total disaster area, but we're redoing everything, and it's going to be gorgeous, like one of the houses in Domino.
Who is we? Ainsley wonders.
She says, I thought you and Aunt Harper had agreed to tear it down.
Harper wanted to tear it down. She didn't see the potential. Do you know what we found under the wall-to-wall carpeting?
Ainsley tries to guess what would be exciting to someone like her mother.
Savings bonds? She says.
Basically, Tabitha says, there are random width heart pine floors under the carpet.
Sick, Ainsley says. Then she remembers that her mother dislikes this response.
So tell me, Tabitha says, how's the store?
The store is good, Ainsley says. She isn't sure what Harper has told Tabitha about the changes they've made at the boutique.
It's really busy all the time. Megan says sales are way up.
Mm-hmm, Tabitha says.
I heard you had a party.
Ainsley is caught off guard by this.
A party?
Megan told me, Tabitha says. I heard all about the punch and the popcorn.
I didn't drink any of the punch, Ainsley says.
And the avocado toasts? And the music?
The thing is, Mama, since the party, the reputation of the store has totally changed.
Oh, I'm sure it has, Tabitha says.
No, for the better. It's become a place where people want to shop. It's hip now. It's cool.
Your grandmother doesn't want a hip shop or a cool shop, Tabitha says. Your grandmother wants a dignified shop, a classic, timeless shop. That has always been the idea. That has always been the guiding principle.
But her designs aren't timeless, Ainsley says. That's why her Newbury Street store closed, isn't it? The only people who want to buy the ERF label are like 100 years old.
Your aunt is cheapening the brand, Tabitha says. She has always sullied everything she touches, and this is no different.
Mama, Ainsley says.
But I've washed my hands of it for the summer, Tabitha says. And I haven't said a word to your grandmother because she's trying to heal, but I assure you she will be very unhappy, and it's entirely Harper's fault.
Why do you hate Aunt Harper so much? Ainsley asks.
Tabitha ignores the question. I am curious about one thing, she says. Megan says you hired a new sales associate.
Yes, Ainsley says.
She wonders how bad it would be if she hung up right now and later claimed the call dropped.
Who is it?
I meant to call the boutique and find out, but I've been consumed with this renovation.
Ainsley?
Ainsley considers lying and making up a name. Carrie Bradshaw, or no, that won't work, so something else. But she will be found out. And what is her new pledge? To be a good person. To tell the truth.
Kaylee Keohane, she says.
There is silence. Ainsley cringes.
Then Tabitha says, Kaylee? The little girl Ramsey dates?
Dated, Ainsley squeaks.
They broke up. They broke up before we hired her.
Ainsley wants to speak up in Kaylee's defense and explain the Facebook posts and the outfit of the day and how successful this campaign has been and why Kaylee is such a good person and a team player. And what a kind, supportive friend she's been to Ainsley. And she's not a little girl. She's 22 years old, an adult. But Ainsley is afraid that if she defends Kaylee, her mother will only get angrier. So she says nothing.
Huh,
Tabitha says, and she hangs up. Ainsley rides her bike home as fast as she can. When she reaches the carriage house, she runs upstairs. For the first time all summer, the central air is on, and Aunt Harper is wrapped in the mohair blanket from Nantucket Looms, which cost as much as a new car. Tabitha doesn't like Ainsley to use it. The blinds have been pulled, and the upstairs is as dark as a cave. Ainsley stares at her aunt. Is she sick?
Hey,
Ainsley says. She nudges her aunt.
Are you okay, Aunt Harper?
It's not like her aunt to sleep in the middle of the day. On her other days off, she is a regular Vasco da Gama, out exploring parts of the island Ainsley didn't even know existed. Harper's eyes flutter open.
Yes, she says, I'm just really, really tired. I'm sorry.
You don't have to be sorry, Ainsley says, but I need to tell you something.
Harper sits up, gingerly, it seems, with her arm bracing her midsection as though her stomach hurts, and she brings her feet to the floor.
What is it?
I talked to Tabitha, Ainsley says. My mother, I mean.
Okay.
She found out about the party. She says we're sullying the ERF brand, making it less distinctive or distinguished or whatever.
Harper scoffs. Of course she said that. She must not care about actual money.
But that's not what I'm worried about, Ainsley says.
What are you worried about?
She asked who we hired to work in the boutique, and I told her it was Kaylee, and she hung up on me.
She'll get over it, Harper says. Kaylee is a stellar employee. Tabitha is just bitter.
But what if she comes back here and fires Kaylee? Ainsley says. What if she shows up and undoes all the changes we've made?
Harper stands up to give Ainsley a hug. You don't have to worry about this. This is old, old stuff between me and your mom coming to the surface. We disagree on, well, just about everything. I don't want you getting caught in the middle.
I just want things to stay like they are right now, Ainsley says. If my mother comes home, everything will go back to the way it was. But I think maybe she's too busy renovating Gramps' house to come back here.
We're tearing Gramps' house down, Harper says.
No,
Ainsley says.
Mama is renovating it, she said. I guess she found some kind of special wood under the carpet.
What? Harper says. Her voice is suddenly loud and sharp, and Ainsley takes a step backwards. She congratulates herself for somehow managing to make things worse.
Does she not understand I need money? I can't wait 6 months or a year to see the sale proceeds. I can't spend $150,000 on a chair rail and Berber rugs and a clawfoot tub and whatever else she thinks that house needs. I need money. I need security. I need a nest egg.
Harper grabs her phone. I'm putting an end to this.
No,
Ainsley thinks. Harper goes down to her bedroom. Ainsley hears her shout,
Tabitha, what have you done? We agreed to tear the house down, put the land on the market, and sell it.
Ainsley collapses on the sofa and holds her head in her hands. She had thought the experiment of her mother and aunt switching places was working.
You don't know what the Vineyard Haven real estate market is like, Harper screams. It could be a year or longer until we see any money.
She pauses, and Ainsley assumes her mother is talking.
It's not tit for tat. I threw that party because I was trying to help the store. I was trying to improve sales and make some money to pay the rent, and I did.
You're renovating Billy's house because you want a vanity project. I should file a cease and desist order.
Well, fine. Maybe I will. We'll see how little you care when the sheriff comes to visit.
Ainsley groans. The experiment is not working. The following afternoon, when Ainsley enters the carriage house, she hears fish barking, and she knows there's trouble. Her mother is here, she thinks, and her stomach drops to her feet. The FJ40 wasn't in the driveway, but that doesn't mean anything. It's high summer. Maybe she couldn't get it across on the ferry. Maybe it's parked over in front of Seamless. Ainsley didn't think to look. Ainsley takes the stairs two at a time and finds Aunt Harper kneeling on the living room floor, her phone in one hand, her eyes squeezed shut, her mouth open but no sound coming out.
Aunt Harper, Ainsley says, what is it? What happened?
She immediately thinks this is her mother's fault, or her grandmother's. Maybe they're the ones who have called the sheriff or filed legal action. Her aunt rocks back on her heels and lets out a strangled cry. Ainsley instinctively knows that something big has happened, something bigger than a disagreement about store policy or Vineyard real estate. Someone is dead. But who? Who? It takes a few minutes for Ainsley to get Harper calmed down enough to piece together the story. It's not her mother, and it's not Eleanor. It's a friend of Aunt Harper's, a close friend, a boyfriend maybe, a man named Brendan. He killed himself, overdosed intentionally on pills. Ainsley's stomach sours. Suicide combines the awful shock of an unexpected death with something even more sinister. To kill yourself means to experience the ultimate blackness. It means inhabiting a room with no air, no light, no hope. It terrifies Ainsley.
His mother told me he wasn't doing well, Harper says through her tears. But I didn't go back. I thought if I went back, I would make things worse. And look, I've made things worse. He's gone, and it's my fault.
No, Ainsley says. She doesn't know anything about this person, Brendan, or his relationship with her aunt, but calling his suicide her fault feels wrong. Her aunt is a loving soul, kind all the way to her core. She has confessed to Ainsley that she has made a bunch of poor choices in her life. She didn't make the most of her potential. She got mixed up with some bad people, and she knowingly betrayed some good people. She hasn't gone into much detail about any of this, nor has she explained why Tabitha hates her so much. She has been too busy tending to Ainsley and the store and Ramsey and Kaylee and Megan and Fish. But now Harper is the one who needs tending to.
No, not your fault. Don't say that again.
Ainsley tries to think what Harper needs most right that second. Ice water, arms around her, then action, a plan. They will go to the vineyard. Harper, Ainsley, and Fish. Ainsley will book the ferry. She will ask Megan to cover their shifts at work. She will help Harper get back home.